when its use was more nefarious, but it no longer needs to signal out to sea. Quite the contrary, there is none among us now who wishes exposure, and one can never be too careful, for where there is much to gain, there is ever much to lose. Chapter 39, Blackhurst Manor, 1909. Rose was weeping. Her cheek was warm and her pillow wet, but still she wept. She clenched her eyes against the sneaking winter light and cried as she hadn't since she was a very little girl. Wicked, wicked morning. How dare the sun so surely rise to gloat over her misery? How dare other people go about their business as if God were in his heaven, when yet again Rose had woken to see the end to her hopes writ in blood? How much longer, she wondered, how many more times must she tolerate this monthly despair? In some ghastly way it was better to know, for surely the worst days were those in between, the long days in which Rose allowed herself to imagine, to dream, to hope. Hope! How she had grown to hate the word. It was an insidious seed planted inside a person's soul, surviving covertly on little tending, then flowering so spectacularly that none could help but cherish it. It was hope, too, that prevented a person taking counsel from experience. For each month after her bleeding week, Rose felt a resurgence of the foul creature, and her slate of experience was wiped clean. No matter that she promised herself that this time she wouldn't play along, wouldn't fall prey to the cruel, propitious whispers, she always did, because desperate people cling to hope like sailors to their wreck. In the course of a year, there had been one small reprieve from the terrible cycle. A month when the bleeding hadn't come. Dr. Matthews had been duly summoned, had conducted an examination, and uttered the blessed words, "She was with child." What bliss to hear one's dearest wish spoken so calmly, with so little thought for the months of disappointment that had come before, with steadiness and confidence that all would continue. Her stomach would swell, and a baby would be born. 8 days she had nursed the precious news, whispered words of love to her flat stomach, walked and spoken and dreamed differently. And then on the 9th day, a knock at the door, but Rose didn't stir. "Go away," she thought, "go away and leave me be." The door creaked and someone entered, took infuriating care to be quiet. A noise, something being placed on the bedside table, and then a soft voice by her ear. "I brought you some breakfast." Mary again, as if it wasn't enough that Mary had seen the sheets, marked with their dark reproach. "You must keep your spirits up, Mrs. Walker." Mrs. Walker. The words made Rose's stomach tighten. How she'd longed to be Mrs. Walker. After she'd met Nathaniel in New York, had arrived at dance after dance with her heart pulsing in her chest, scanned the room until she spied him, held her breath until their eyes met and his lips spread into a smile, just for her. And now the name was hers, yet she had proved herself unworthy of it. A wife who couldn't perform the most basic of a married woman's functions. Couldn't provide her husband with the very things a good wife must. Children. Healthy, happy children to run across the estate, turn cartwheels along the sand, hide from their governess. "You mustn't cry, Mrs. Walker. It'll happen for you in good time." Each well-meant word was a bitter barb. "Will it, Mary?" "Of course, ma'am." "What makes you so sure?" "It's bound to, ain't it? A woman can't avoid it if she tries. Not for long. There is many I know would be glad to escape it, if way were known. Ungrateful wretches, said Rose, face hot and wet. Such women don't deserve the blessing of children. Mary's eyes clouded with something Rose took for pity. Rather than slap the servant's plump, healthy cheeks, she turned away and curled up beneath her covers, nursed her grief deep within her stomach, surrounded herself with the dark and empty cloud of loss. Nathaniel could have drawn it in his sleep. His wife's face was so familiar to him, he sometimes thought he knew it better than his own hand. He finished the line he was sketching and smudged it slightly with his thumb, squinted and tilted his head. She was beautiful. He had been right in that. The dark hair and pale skin, pretty mouth, and yet he took no pleasure from it. He filed the portrait sketch in his portfolio. She would be glad to receive it, as she always was. Her requests for new portraits were so desperate, he could never say no. If he didn't present a new one every few days, she was likely to weep and beg him for assurances of love. He drew her from memory now, rather than from life. The latter was too painful. His Rose had vanished inside her own sorrow. The young woman he had met in New York had been eaten away, revealing this shadow Rose, with darkened eyes from lack of sleep, worry-faded skin, agitated limbs. Had any poet adequately described the wretched ugliness of a loved one turned inside out with grief? Night after night she presented herself to him, and he consented. But Nathaniel's desire had vanished. What had once excited him filled him now with dread and, worse, guilt. Guilt that when they made love he could no longer bear to look at her. Guilt that he could not give her what she wanted. Guilt that he did not want the baby as desperately as she did. Not that Rose would believe that. No matter how many times Nathaniel assured her that she was enough for him, Rose would not be convinced. And now, most mortifying of all, her mother had come to see him in his studio, had perused his portrait somewhat woodenly before sitting in the chair by his easel and launching her oration. Rose was delicate, she started, had always been so. The animal drives of a husband were likely to cause her great harm, and it would be best for all if he could desist for a time. So disquieting was it to conduct such a conversation with his mother-in-law, Nathaniel had been unable to find words or inclination to explain his own position. Instead, he had nodded his accession and taken to seeking solitude in the estate garden rather than his studio. The gazebo had become his workplace. It was still cool in March, but Nathaniel was only too willing to forgo comfort. The weather made it less likely that anyone else would seek his counsel. Finally, he could be at ease. Being inside the house over winter, with Rose's parents and her suffocating needs, had been oppressive. Her sorrow and disappointment had permeated the walls, the curtains, the carpets. It was the house of the dead. Linus locked away in his dark room, Rose in the bedroom, Adeline lurking in the corridors. Nathaniel leaned forward, attention caught by the spill of weak sunlight through the rhododendron branches. His fingers twitched, longed to capture the light and shade. But there was no time. The canvas of Lord Mackleby sat before him on the easel, beard painted in, blush-shot cheeks, lined forehead. Only the eyes remained. It was always the eyes that let Nathaniel down in oil. He selected a brush and removed a loose hair. Was about to put paint to canvas when he felt his arms tingle, the strange sixth sense of solitude retreating. He looked over his shoulder. Sure enough, a servant stood behind him. Agitation bristled. "For goodness sake, man," said Nathaniel, "don't sneak up like that. If there's something you'd like to say, come, stand before me and say it. There's no need, surely, for such stealth. Lady Montrachet sends advice that luncheon is to be served early, sir. The carriage for Tremaine Hall will depart at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Nathaniel cursed silently. He had forgotten about Tremaine Hall. Yet another of Adeline's wealthy friends looking to dress their walls in their own image. Perhaps, if he were very lucky, his subject would insist he also feature her 3 tiny dogs. To think he had once been thrilled by such introductions, had felt his status rising like the sail on a new ship. He had been a blind fool, ignorant to the cost that such success would claim. His commissions had grown, but his creativity had been reduced commensurately. He was pumping out portraits just as surely as one of the new mass-production factories of which men in business were always speaking, rubbing their shiny hands together with glee. No time to pause, to improve, to vary his method. His work was not that of a craftsman. There was no longer dignity or humanity in his strokes. Worst of all, while he was busy producing portraits, the time for sketching his true passion was slipping through his fingers. Since arriving at Blackhurst, he had managed only 1 panel sketch and a clutch of studies of the house and its inhabitants. His hands, his skills, his spirits had all been stunted. He had made the wrong choice. He saw that now. If only he had heeded Rosa's requests and sought a new home for them after their marriage, perhaps things would have turned out differently. Perhaps they would be blissfully content, children at her feet, creative satisfaction at his fingertips. Then again, perhaps all would be the same. He and she forced to endure similar torture in reduced circumstances. And that was the rub. How was a boy who'd tasted poverty ever expected to choose the poorer road? And now Adeline, like Eve herself, had started whispering about a possible sitting with the king. And though he was tired of portraiture, though he hated himself for having forsaken so completely his passion, Nathaniel's skin prickled at the mere suggestion. He laid down his brush and rubbed at a paint stain on his thumb. Was about to head in for luncheon when his portfolio snagged his attention. With a glance back towards the house, he pulled the secret sketches from within. He'd been working at them on and off for a fortnight now, ever since he'd come across Cousin Eliza's fairy tales amongst Rosa's things. Though they were written for children, magical stories of bravery and morality, they had made their way beneath his skin. The characters had seeped inside his mind and come alive, their simple wisdom a balm for his swirling mind, his ugly adult troubles. He had found himself in moments of distraction, scribbling lines that had turned themselves into a crone at a spinning wheel, the fairy queen with her long, thick plait, the princess bird trapped in her golden cage. And what began as scribbles, he was now turning into sketches, darkening the shading, firming the lines, accentuating the facial features. He looked them over, tried not to notice the embossed parchment Rose had bought for him when they were newly married, tried not to think of happier times. The sketches were not yet finished, but he was pleased with them. Indeed, it was the only project that seemed to bring him pleasure any more, grant him escape from the trial his life had become. With a quickening heart, Nathaniel clipped the pieces of parchment to the top of his easel. After luncheon, he was going to allow himself to sketch, to draw without purpose as he had once done as a boy. Lord Mackleby's gloomy eyes could wait. Finally, with Mary's help, Rose was dressed. She had been sitting in her convalescent chair all morning, but had decided eventually to venture from her room. When had she last left its 4 walls? 2 days before? 3? When she stood, she almost fell. She was light-headed and weak-stomached, familiar sensations from her childhood. Back then, Eliza had been able to hoist her spirits high again with fairy stories and tales dragged back from the cove. If only the remedy for adult affliction were so simple. It had been some time since Rose had seen Eliza. She spied her occasionally from the window, stalking through the garden or standing on the cliff top, a distant speck with long red hair streaming behind her. Once or twice Mary had come to the door with a message that Miss Eliza was downstairs requesting an audience, but Rose always said no. She loved her cousin, but the battle she was waging against grief and hope took all the energy she could muster. And Eliza was so spirited, so full of vitality, possibility, health. It was more than Rose could endure. Weightless as a ghost, Rose drifted along the carpeted hall, hand resting on the dado rail to keep her balance. This afternoon, when Nathaniel returned from his meeting at Tremaine Hall, she would join him outside in the gazebo. It would be cold, of course, but she would have Mary wrap her warmly. Thomas could move the daybed and a blanket for her comfort. Nathaniel must be lonely out there. He would be glad to have her by his side once more. He would be able to sketch her reclining. Nathaniel did so like to draw her, and it was her duty as a wife to offer comfort to her husband. Rose had almost reached the stairs when she heard voices floating along the draughty corridor. "She says she ain't gonna say nothing, that it's no one's business but hers." The words were punctuated by the striking of a broom's head against the skirting board. "The mistress won't be pleased when she finds out."
"The mistress won't find out?"
"If she's got eyes in her head, she will. There is not many can't tell when a girl grows fat with child." Rose pressed a cold hand against her mouth, crept quietly along the hall, strained to hear further.
"She says all the women in her family carry small. She'll be able to hide it beneath her uniform."
"Let's just hope for her sake she's right, else she'll be out on her ear." Rose arrived at the top of the stairs just in time to see Daisy disappearing into the servants' hall. Sally was denied such fortunate reprieve. The servant gasped, and her cheeks flushed in most unbecoming blotches.
"Sorry, ma'am."
A fumbled curtsy, broomstick tangled in skirts.
"I didn't see you there."
"Of whom do you speak, Sally?"
The blotches spread to the tips of the girl's ears.
"Sally," said Rose, "I demand you answer me. Who is with child?"
"Mary, ma'am."
Little more than a whisper.
"Mary?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Mary is with child?"
The girl nodded quickly, the lines of her face describing an urgent desire to disappear.
"I see."
A deep black hole had opened in the center of Rose's stomach and threatened to pull her inside out.
That stupid girl with her hideous, cheap fertility. Flaunting it, for all to see, cooing over Rose, telling her everything would be well, then laughing behind her back. And she unwed. Well, not in this house. Blackhurst Manor was a house of ancient and sturdy moral standing. It was up to Rose to make sure standards were observed.
Adeline ran the brush through her hair, stroke by stroke by stroke. Mary was gone, and though that left them woefully short-staffed for the coming weekend party, the girl's absence would just have to be managed. While ordinarily Adeline didn't encourage Rose to make decisions about staff without due consultation, these were exceptional circumstances, and Mary quite the little sneak. An unmarried sneak, which made matters even more disgraceful. No, Rose had been right in her instincts, if not her method. Poor dear Rose. Dr. Matthews had been to see Adeline earlier in the week, had sat across from her in the morning room and adopted his low voice, the one he always donned in times of worry. Rose was not well, he had said, as if Adeline couldn't see as much for herself, and he was gravely concerned. Unfortunately, Lady Mountrachet, my fears are not limited to her apparent decline. There are... he coughed lightly into his neat fist. Other things.
Other things, Dr. Matthews?
Adeline handed him a cup of tea. Emotional matters, Lady Mountrachet. He smiled primly and took a sip of tea. When questioned on the physical aspects of her marriage, Mrs. Walker confessed to what would be considered, in my professional opinion, an unhealthy tendency towards physicality. Adeline felt her lungs expand. She caught her breath and forced herself to exhale calmly. For want of something else to say or do, she stirred an additional lump of sugar into her own tea. Without meeting his eyes, she bade Dr. Matthews continue. Be comforted, Lady Mountrachet. While certainly it's a serious condition, your daughter is not alone. I can report a rather high incidence of heightened physicality among young ladies currently, and feel certain it is a condition she will outgrow. More concerning to me is my suspicion that her physical tendency is contributing to her repeated failures. Adeline cleared her throat.
Continue, Dr. Matthews.
It is my sincere medical opinion that your daughter must cease physical relations until her poor body has had time adequately to recover. For 'tis all related, Lady Mountrachet. 'Tis all related. Adeline lifted her cup to her mouth and tasted the bitterness of fine china. She nodded almost imperceptibly. The Lord works in mysterious ways. So too, through his design, the human body. It is reasonable to hypothesize that a young lady with heightened appetites... he smiled apologetically, eyes narrowed, would present a less than ideal maternal model. The body knows such things, Lady Mountrachet.
You are suggesting, Dr. Matthews, that with fewer attempts, my daughter may have greater success.
It is worth consideration, Lady Mountrachet. Not to mention the benefits such temperance will have for her general health and well-being. Picture, if you will, Lady Mountrachet, a windsock.
Adeline arched her eyebrows, wondered, not for the first time, why she had remained loyal to Dr. Matthews all this time.
If a windsock is left suspended for years on end, without opportunity for rest or repair, the harsh winds will invariably tear holes in its fabric. So too, Lady Mountrachet, your daughter must be allowed time to recuperate, must be shielded from the strong winds that threaten to rend her asunder.
Windsocks aside, a certain sense had lurked behind Dr. Matthews's words. Rose was weak and unwell, and without allowing herself proper time to heal, could not be expected to make a full recovery. And yet her fierce longing for a child consumed her. Adeline had agonized over how best to convince her daughter to put her own health first, and finally she had realized it would be necessary to enlist Nathaniel in the attempt. Awkward though such a conversation promised to be, his obedience had been assured. Over the past 12 months, Nathaniel had learned to toe Adeline's line, and now with a royal portrait in the offing, there'd been little doubt he'd see things her way. Although Adeline managed to keep a calm veneer, oh, how she raged in private. Why should other young women be granted children when Rose must go without? Why should she be blighted when others were made strong?
How much more would Rose's weak body be forced to endure? In her darkest moments, Adeline wondered whether it was something she had done, whether maybe God was punishing her. She had been too proud, gloated one too many times about Rose's beauty, her fine manners, her sweet nature. For what worse punishment than to see a beloved child suffering? And now the thought of Mary, that ghastly, healthy girl with her broad, beaming face, her nest of unkempt hair, that she should be carrying a child, an unwanted child, when others who craved so deeply were continually denied. There was no justice. Little wonder Rose had snapped. It was her turn. The happy news, the child, should belong to Rose, not Mary. If only some way could be found to grant Rose a child without physical toll. Of course it was impossible. Women would be lined up if such a method existed. Adeline paused mid-stroke, looked at her reflection, but saw nothing. Her mind was elsewhere, contemplating the topsy-turvy image of a healthy girl with no maternal instinct beside a delicate woman whose body failed her willing heart. She laid down the brush, pressed cold hands together in her lap. Was it possible such contrariness might be righted? It would not be easy. First, Rose must be convinced that it was for the best. Then there was the girl. She would need to be made to see that it was her duty, that she owed it to the Montrachet family after so many years of goodwill. Difficult, certainly, but not impossible. Slowly, Adeline stood, laid the brush lightly on the dressing table. Mind still honing her idea, she started down the hall towards Rose's room. The key to grafting roses was the knife. Razor sharp it had to be, said Davies, sharp enough to give the hairs on your arm a clean shave. Eliza had found him in the hothouse, and he'd been only too happy to help her with the hybrid she was planning for her garden. He'd shown her where to make the cut, how to ensure that there were no splinters or bumps or imperfections that might prevent the scion binding to the new stock. In the end, she'd stayed all morning and helped with the repotting for spring. It was such a pleasure to sink one's hands into the warm earth, to feel at one's fingertips the possibilities of the new season. When she left, Eliza walked the long way back. It was a cool day, thin clouds skimming quickly in the upper atmosphere, and she relished the chill breeze on her face after the muggy hothouse. Being so near, her thoughts turned as they always did to her cousin. Mary had reported that Rose was low in spirits lately, and though Eliza suspected she wouldn't be granted admission, she couldn't bear to come so close without trying. She knocked on the side door and waited until it opened. "Good day, Sally. I've come to see Rose." "You can't, Miss Eliza," said Sally, a sullen expression on her face. "Mrs. Walker is otherwise engaged and unavailable to guests." The lines had the melody of those learned by rote. "Come now, Sally," Eliza said, smile straining. "I hardly qualify as a guest. I'm sure if you just let Rose know that I'm here." From the shadows, Aunt Adeline's voice. "Sally is quite right. Mrs. Walker is otherwise engaged." The dark hourglass drifted into view. "We are about to begin luncheon. If you care to leave a calling card, Sally will ensure that Mrs. Walker knows you requested an audience." Sally's head was bowed and her cheeks flushed. No doubt some fuss had occurred amongst the staff, and Eliza would hear all about it from Mary later. Without Mary and her regular reports, Eliza would have little idea what went on at the house. "I have no card," said Eliza. "Let Rose know I called, won't you, Sally? She knows where to find me. With a nod in her aunt's direction, Eliza set off once more across the lawn, pausing only once to gaze at the window of Rosa's new bedroom, where early spring light bleached the surface to white. With a shiver, her thoughts turned to Davies's grafting knife, the ease with which a sharp enough blade might sever a plant so that no evidence of the former bond remained. Around the sundial and further across the lawn, Eliza came to the gazebo. Nathaniel's painting equipment was set up inside, as it often was these days. He was nowhere to be seen, had probably gone inside for luncheon, but his work had been left pegged to the easel. Eliza's thoughts fled. The sketches on top were unmistakable. She suffered the odd displacement of seeing figments from her own imagination brought to life. Characters, hitherto the province of her own mind, turned as if by magic to pictures. An unexpected ripple passed beneath her skin, hot and cold all at once. Eliza went closer, up the stairs of the gazebo, and examined the sketches. She smiled, couldn't help herself. It was like discovering an imaginary friend had gained corporal existence. They were similar enough to her own imaginings to be instantly recognizable, yet different somehow. His hand was darker than her mind, she realized, and she liked it. Without thinking, she unclipped them. Eliza hurried back, along the maze, across her garden, through the southern door, all the way mulling the sketches over in her mind, wondering when he had drawn them, why, what he intended to do with them. It wasn't until she was hanging her coat and hat in the hallway of the cottage that her thoughts turned to the letter she had recently received from the publisher in London. Mr. Hobbins had opened by paying Eliza a compliment regarding her stories. He had a little daughter, he said, who awaited each Eliza Makepeace fairy tale with bated breath. Then he had suggested Eliza might like to consider publishing an illustrated collection, and to bear him in mind if such time arose. Eliza had been flattered, but unconvinced. For some reason, the concept hadn't progressed in her imagination from the abstract. Now, however, having seen Nathaniel's sketches, she found she could envisage such a book, could almost feel its weight in her hands. A bound edition containing her favorite stories, a volume for children to pore over. Just like the book she had discovered in Mrs. Swindle's rag and bone shop all those years ago. And though Mr. Hobbins's letter had not been explicit about remuneration, surely Eliza could expect payment more handsome than that she had received thus far. For an entire book must be worth far more than a single story. Perhaps she should finally have the money necessary to travel across the sea. A fierce knocking at the door drew her attention. Eliza pushed aside the irrational sense that it was Nathaniel she would see waiting for her on the other side, come for his sketches. Of course it wasn't. He never came to the cottage, and besides, it would be hours before he realized they were missing. All the same, Eliza rolled them up and tucked them within her coat pocket. She opened the door. Mary stood there, cheeks stained with tide lines of tears.
"Please, Miss Eliza, help me."
"Mary, what is it?" Eliza ushered the girl inside, glancing over her shoulder before closing the door. "Are you hurt?"
"No, Miss Eliza." She swallowed a sob. "'Tis nothing like that."
"Then tell me what has happened."
"It's Mrs. Walker."
"Rose?" Eliza's heart hammered against her chest.
"She's turned me out," Mary inhaled wetly. "Told me to finish up. Immediately."
Relief that Rose was unharmed battled with surprise. "But Mary, whatever for?" Mary collapsed onto a chair and wiped the back of her wrist across her eyes.
"I don't know how to say it, Miss Eliza."
Then speak plainly, Mary, I implore you, and tell me what on earth has happened.
Fresh tears began to fall.
I'm with child, Miss Eliza. I'm going to have a baby, and though I thought I kept it hid, Mrs. Walker has found out, and now says I'm not welcome.
Oh, Mary, said Eliza, sinking onto the other chair, taking Mary's hands between her own. Are you sure about the baby?
There is no doubting the fact, Miss Eliza.
I didn't mean for it to happen, but it did.
And who is the father?
A lad what lives in the neighbouring street to ours.
Please, Miss Eliza, he's not a bad fellow, and he says he wants to marry me. But I need to earn some money first, else there'll be naught to feed nor clothe the babe.
I can't lose my position, not yet, Miss Eliza, and I know I can still perform it well.
Mary's face was so desperate that Eliza could answer no other way.
I'll see what I can do.
Will you speak with Mrs. Walker?
Eliza fetched a glass of water from the pitcher and handed it to Mary.
I'll endeavour to do so, though you know as well as I do that an audience with Rose is not easy to obtain.
Please, Miss Eliza, you're my only hope.
Eliza smiled with a confidence she didn't feel.
I will give it a few days, enough time for Rose to settle down, and then I shall speak with her on your behalf. I'm certain she'll be made to see reason.
Oh, thank you, Miss Eliza. You know I didn't wish for this to happen. I've gone and made a mess of everything. I only wish I could turn the weeks back and have it undone.
We have all wished for similar power at times, said Eliza. Go home now, Mary dear, and try not to worry. Things will work out, I'm sure. I will send word when I have spoken with Rose.
Adeline knocked lightly on the bedroom door and pushed it open. Rose was sitting in the window seat, attention focused on the ground below. Her arms were so frail, her profile so gaunt. The room had grown listless in sympathy to its owner, cushions flat, curtains sagging in despondence. Even the air seemed to have staled within the streams of weak light. Rose gave no indication that she noticed or minded the intrusion, so Adeline went to stand behind her. She looked through the window to see what it was that held her daughter's attention. Nathaniel was seated at his easel in the gazebo, sifting through pages from his leather portfolio. There was an agitation in his manner, as if he had misplaced a vital tool.
He will leave me, Mama.
Rose's voice was pale as the sunlight.
For what reason would he stay?
Rose turned then, and Adeline tried not to let her face reflect her daughter's grey and terrible state. She laid a hand on Rose's bony shoulder.
All will be well, my Rose.
Will it? Her tone was so bitter that Adeline winced.
Of course.
I don't see how that can be, for it seems I am unable to make of him a man. Again and again I failed to give him an heir, a child of his own.
Rose turned back to the window.
Of course he will leave, and without him I will fade away to nothing.
I have spoken with Nathaniel, Rose.
Oh, Mama! Adeline lifted a finger to Rose's lips. I have spoken with Nathaniel, and I am confident that he, as I, wants nothing more than your return to good health. Children will come when you are well, and for that you must be patient. Allow yourself the time to recover.
Rose was shaking her head, her neck so thin that Adeline wanted to stop the gesture, lest she damage herself.
I cannot wait, Mama. Without a child, I cannot go on. I would do anything for a baby, even at my own cost. I would rather die than wait.
Adeline sat gently on the window seat and took her daughter's pale, cool hands between her own. It need not come to that. Rose blinked large eyes at Adeline. Within them flickered a pale flame of hope. Hope that a child never quite loses. Faith that a parent can put things to right.
I am your mother, and I must look after your health, even if you won't. Thus have I given your plight much thought. I believe there may be a way for you to have a child without endangering yourself.
Mama?
You may be reluctant at first, but I beg of you, cast aside your doubts.
Adeline lowered her voice.
Pray listen carefully now, Rose, to all I have to say.
In the end, it was Rose who made contact with Eliza. 5 days after Mary's visit, Eliza received word that Rose would like to meet. Even more surprising, Rose's letter suggested that the two should meet in Eliza's hidden garden. When she saw her cousin, Eliza was glad she'd thought to fetch cushions for the iron seat. For dear Rose was reduced in every way. Mary had hinted at a decline, but Eliza had never imagined such extreme diminishment. Though she fought to keep her face from registering shock, Eliza knew she must have failed.
"You are surprised by my appearance, cousin," said Rose, smiling so her cheekbones turned to blades.
"Not at all," Eliza blustered. "Of course not, I merely... my face..."
I know you well, my Eliza. I can read your thoughts as if they were my own. It is all right. I have been unwell. I have weakened. But I will recover, as I always do.
Eliza nodded, felt a warm shot stinging behind her eyes. Rose smiled, a smile all the sadder for its attempt at certitude.
Come, she gestured. Sit by me, Eliza. Let me have my dear cousin by my side. Do you remember the day you first brought me to the hidden garden, and together we planted the apple tree? Eliza took Rose's thin, cold hand.
Of course I do.
And just look at it now, Rose. Look at our tree.
The sapling stem had thrived, so that the tree now reached almost to the top of the wall. Graceful, naked branches swept sideways, and willowy offshoots pointed towards the sky.
"It's beautiful," said Rose wistfully, "to think that we needed only plant it in the earth, and it knew just what to do."
Eliza smiled gently. "It has done only what nature intended for it." Rose bit her lip, left a red mark.
Sitting here, I almost believe myself 18 again, on the verge of my trip to New York, filled with excitement and anticipation.
She smiled at Eliza.
It feels like an age since we've sat together, just you and I, as we used to when we were girls.
A wave of nostalgia washed away the year of envy and disappointment. Eliza clasped Rose's hand tightly.
"Indeed it does, cousin."
Rose coughed a little, and her frail body shook with the effort. Eliza was about to offer a shawl for her shoulders when Rose started speaking again.
"I wonder, have you had news from the house lately?"
Eliza answered cautiously, wondering at the sudden change of topic.
"I have seen Mary."
"Then you know." Rose met Eliza's gaze, held it for a time before shaking her head sadly.
"She left me no choice, cousin. I understand that you and she were fond of each other, but it was unthinkable that she should be kept on at Blackhurst in such a state. You must see that." She is a good and loyal girl, Rose, said Eliza gently. She has behaved imprudently, I don't deny that. But surely you might relent. She is without income, and the baby she is growing will have needs she must fulfill. Please think about Mary, Rose. Imagine her plight.
I assure you, little else has been in my thoughts.
Then perhaps you will see. Have you ever longed for something, Eliza? Something you wanted so much that without it you knew you could live no longer? Eliza thought of her imagined sea voyage, her love for Sammy, her need for Rose.
I want a child more than anything. My heart aches, as do my arms. Sometimes I can feel the weight of the child I long to cradle, the warm head in the crook of my elbow.
And surely one day, yes, yes, one day. Rose's faint smile belied her optimistic words. But I have struggled and done without for so long. 12 months, Eliza. 12 months, and the road has been filled with such disappointment and denial. Now Dr. Matthews instructs me that my health may let me down. You must imagine, Eliza, how Mary's little secret made me feel. That she should have by accident the very thing I crave. That she, with nothing to offer, shall have that which I, with everything, have been denied. Why, surely you can see it isn't right. Surely God does not intend such contrary occurrences. Rose's devastation was so complete, her frail appearance so at odds with her fierce desire, that suddenly Mary's well-being was the least of Eliza's concerns. How can I help you, Rose? Tell me, what can I do? There is something, Cousin Eliza. I need you to do something for me. Something that will in turn help Mary, too. Finally, as Eliza had always known she must, Rose had realized that she needed Eliza. That only Eliza could help her. Of course, Rose, she said. Anything. Tell me what you need, and so shall it be. Chapter 40. Tregenna, 2005. The weather came in late Friday night, and fog sulked grey and general across the village all weekend. Given such resolute inclemency, Cassandra decided her weary limbs could do with a rest and took a well-earned break from the cottage. She spent Saturday curled up in her room with cups of tea and Nell's notebook, intrigued by her grandmother's account of the detective she'd consulted in Truro. A man named Ned Morrish, whose name she'd plucked from the local telephone book after William Martin suggested that she'd figure out her riddle if she learned where Eliza had disappeared to in 1909. On Sunday, Cassandra met with Julia for afternoon tea. Rain had fallen steadily all morning, but by mid-afternoon the deluge was reduced to drizzle, and fog had been allowed to settle in the gaps. Through the mullioned windows, Cassandra could make out only the sober green of the drenched lawn. All else was mist, bare branches visible occasionally, like hairline fractures in a wall of white. It was the sort of day Nell had loved. Cassandra smiled, remembering how pulling on a raincoat and gumboots had infused her grandmother with enthusiasm. Perhaps, from somewhere deep inside, Nell's heritage had been calling her. Cassandra leaned back into the cushions of her armchair and watched the flames flickering in the grate. People were gathered in all corners of the hotel lounge, some playing board games, others reading or eating, and the room was dense with the comforting low voices of the warm and dry. Julia dropped a spoonful of cream onto her jam-laden scone. So, why the sudden interest in the cottage wall? Cassandra's fingers flattened warm around her mug. Nell believed that if she found out where Eliza went in 1909, she'd discover the answer to her own mystery. But what's that got to do with the wall?
I don't know. Maybe nothing. But something in Rose's scrapbook got me thinking.
Which bit?
She makes an entry in April 1909 that seems to link Eliza's trip with the building of the wall. Julia licked cream from her fingertip.
I remember, she said. She writes that bit about being careful because when there's a lot to gain, there's also a lot to lose.
Exactly. I just wish I knew what she meant.
Julia bit her lip. How rude of her not to elaborate for the benefit of those of us who'd be reading over her shoulder some 90 years later.
Cassandra smiled absently, played with a thread coming loose from the chair's arm.
Why would she have said that, though? What was there to gain? What was she so worried about losing? And what does the security of the cottage have to do with any of it?
Julia took a bite of her scone and chewed it slowly, thoughtfully. She patted her lips with a hotel serviette.
Rose was pregnant at the time, right?
According to that entry in the scrapbook.
So maybe it was hormones. That can happen, can't it? Women get all emotional and such. Maybe she was missing Eliza and worried that the cottage would be robbed or vandalized. Maybe she felt responsible. The two girls were still close at that point.
Cassandra thought about this. Pregnancy could account for some pretty crazy mood swings, but was it enough of an answer? Even allowing for a hormonal narrator, there was something curious about the entry. What was happening at the cottage that made Rose feel so vulnerable?
They say it's going to clear up tomorrow, said Julia, laying her knife across a crumb-laden plate.
She leaned back into her armchair, pulled the curtain edge aside, and gazed into the misty glare.
I suppose you'll be back at work in the cottage?
Actually, no. I've got a friend coming to stay.
Here at the hotel?
Cassandra nodded.
Lovely. You just let me know if there's anything I can do to help.
Julia was right. By Monday afternoon, the mist had finally begun to lift, and a tremulous sun promised to break through the clouds. Cassandra was waiting in the lounge when Ruby's car pulled into the car park outside. She smiled when she saw the little white hatchback, packed up the scrapbooks, and hurried into the foyer.
Phew!
Ruby took a step inside and dropped her bags. Then she pulled off her rain hat and shook her head.
Talk about a good old Cornish welcome! Not a drop of rain, and I'm still soaking wet.
She stopped still and stared at Cassandra.
Well now, look at you.
What? Cassandra patted her hair down.
What's the matter with me?
Ruby grinned so that her eyes pleated at the corners.
Nothing at all, that's what I bloody well mean. You look fabulous.
Oh. Well, thanks.
The Cornish air must agree with you. You're hardly the same girl I met at Heathrow.
Cassandra started to laugh, surprising Samantha, who was eavesdropping from the main desk.
It's really good to see you, Ruby, she said, picking up one of the bags.
Let's get rid of these and go for a walk. Check out the cove after all this rain. Cassandra closed her eyes, tilted her face skyward, and let the sea breeze tickle her eyelids. Gulls engaged in conversation further along the beach. An insect flew close by her ear. Gentle waves lapped rhythmically against the coast. She felt an enormous sense of calm descend as she matched her breath to that of the sea. In and out. In and out. In and out. The recent rain had stirred up the ocean brine, and the strong smell laced the wind. She opened her eyes and looked slowly about the cove, the line of ancient trees atop the ridge, the black rock at the cove's end,
the tall grassy hills that hid her cottage. She exhaled. Deep pleasure.
I feel just like I've stumbled into Five Goatus Smuggler's Top, called Ruby from further along the beach. I keep expecting Timmy the dog to come running down the sand with a message-filled bottle in his mouth. Her eyes widened. Or a human bone. Some nefarious thing he's dug up. Cassandra smiled. I used to love that book. She started walking along the pebbles towards Ruby and the black rock. When I was a kid, reading it on hot Brisbane days, I'd have given anything to be growing up on a foggy coast with smugglers' caves. When they reached the end of the beach where pebbles met grass, the steep coastal hill that bounded the cove rose before them.
"Good Lord," said Ruby, craning to see the top. "You actually intend for us to climb that, don't you?"
"It's not as steep as it looks, I promise." Time and traffic had worn a narrow path, barely visible amongst the long silvery grasses and little yellow flowers, and they went slowly, stopping every so often for Ruby to catch her breath. Cassandra relished the clear, rain-stirred air. The higher they got, the cooler it became. Each swirl of breeze was flecked with moisture, swept from the sea to pepper their faces. As she neared the top, Cassandra reached out to grasp the long, pale strands of grass, felt them slide through her closed hands. "Nearly there," she called back to Ruby. "It's just over this crest."
"I feel like a Von Trapp," Ruby said between puffs, "but fatter, older, and with absolutely no energy for singing."
Cassandra reached the summit. Above her, thin clouds fleeted across the sky, chased by strong autumn winds. She wandered towards the cliff edge and looked out across the broad and moody sea. Ruby's voice from behind, "Oh, thank God, I'm alive." She was standing with her hands on her knees, catching her breath.
"I'll let you in on a secret. I was not confident this moment would ever arrive."
She righted herself, shifted her hands to the small of her back, and came to stand by Cassandra. Her expression lightened as her eyes scanned the horizon.
"It's beautiful, isn't it?" said Cassandra.
Ruby was shaking her head.
"It's amazing. This is what birds must feel like when they're sitting in their nests."
She took a step back from the cliff edge.
"Except possibly a little more secure, given they have wings in the event of a fall."
"The cottage used to be a lookout, back in the days of the smugglers." Ruby nodded.
"I can believe that well enough. Not much you wouldn't see from up here."
She turned, expecting to catch sight of the cottage. Frowned.
"Shame about that great big wall. It must block a lot of the view."
"Yeah, from downstairs it does. But it wasn't always there. It went up in 1909. Ruby wandered over towards the gate.
"Why on earth would anyone wall it up like that?"
"Security."
"Against what?"
Cassandra followed Ruby.
"Believe me, I'd love to know."
She pushed open the creaky iron gate.
"Friendly?"
Ruby pointed at the sign threatening trespassers. Cassandra smiled thoughtfully. "Keep out, or the risk be all yours." She had passed by the sign so often in recent weeks that she'd stopped seeing it. Now, in tandem with Rose's scrapbook